I knew I had to leave the village. I had, however, already hit upon a plan. It was not one of my more elaborate schemes, but that was perfectly fine. In this situation, simpler was probably superior. Housed by you was a small, isolated village. Such a thing as news was non-existent. None of the villagers ever left town, except for Clef Chin, who would, every so often, haul the excess wheat to a larger city and exchange it for supplies that were not readily handy. Other than that, the people of House Bayou were more or less self-sufficient and knew nothing of what transpired beyond their boundaries, which meant that they'd have no idea if I was successful in my quest or not beyond what I told them. Faced with a problematic situation, I realized, upon further consideration, that instead I had a win-win scenario on my hands. I would pack my few belongings and depart. Granted, smuggling out Chin Pan Ali's sword was going to be a bit of a challenge, but I was up to it. Once I left, I would simply wander about for as long as seemed a reasonable time. Who knew? Perhaps I would happen upon a situation that was superior to the one I'd initially stumbled into. But if I didn't, then, when enough time had passed, I would return to House Bayou and simply tell the people that I'd done exactly what I'd set out to do. I'd certainly have more than enough time to come up with a good story as to how I'd accomplished it. I'd make sure it was filled with much daring do, adventure, and even a bit of tragedy. I'd give myself a sweet young thing who would die pitifully at the 11th hour trying to save her great love. Me, of course. And I'd include an evil villainess who wasn't at all what she appeared. Gods knew I had enough experience with that. And at the end, I would survive all the challenges and leave everyone else in the dust, annihilated. Chin Pan Ali would be avenged, and honor would be right. Even as I mentally congratulated myself, I was appalled at the glee I found in devising a way to bamboozle these people. It made me wonder how anyone ever felt good about themselves. After all, virtually everyone I'd ever encountered, until I came to Chin Pan, had been something of a right bastard. Were they happier than I? Was anyone? And if so, how did they manage it? Was it that I was entirely too self-aware? Or that they were simply oblivious? I mean, as much as I despised myself, there were so many, so damned many, who were so much worse. At least I'd like to tell myself that. Were they eaten up with the same self-doubts, frustrations, and loathing as I? Was the concept of human happiness mere myth? Was the only difference between me and the rest of those I'd encountered that I was the one-eyed man in the proverbial land of the blind? And if so, when the hell did I get to be king? Well, what about the people of House Bayou, I wondered? They were decent people. They felt consistently good about themselves. What were they doing differently? Was it something in the food? Something in the air? Philosophies? Religion? Or was it that they weren't actually all that superior after all? There was always that possibility. Consider the joy with which they agreed at the news that I was going to seek vengeance for the death of Ali. Perhaps they were so cheered because they burned with as much dark need for retribution as anyone else. Yes, that was probably it. Despite their outer trappings of righteousness and goodness, deep down they were as scummy as anyone else, including me, and cowardly. They were cowardly too, hanging back and letting me attend to the job of vengeance. The thought should have made me happy. Instead, it made me more depressed and more filled with self-loathing than ever before. It was nice to know that there were some things on which I could always count. I looked up. Clef Chin was standing there, scowling at me. He wasn't bowing. He continued to scowl.
Problem?
He didn't step in. It was as if he thought he would be contaminated if he set foot into the place.
I know you.
Yes, I should think you...
I have been watching you. I know your type. I know how you think.
Oh, do you? And how do I think precisely?
You think beyond matters of mere vengeance. You do nothing unless there is some personal gain for you.
He'd certainly read me well enough. Still, I wasn't about to say, well done, you fellow. You've got me pegged.
Really? And what personal gain would I derive from seeking out Ali's murderers?
I was ready for him to say none, you poser.
You want the reward.
Reward? The reward for the destruction of the Nais ninjas?
And for the forked tongue.
And how would I know these things, considering I am still relatively new to your land?
The others would have told you. These things are generally known to our people. No doubt you saw this as an opportunity to enrich yourself while cloaking yourself in the righteousness of an honorable quest of vengeance.
No doubt. It is said that ignorance and arrogance are a devastating combination. The ignorant man you can outthink. The arrogant man you can trip up using his overconfidence against him. The man who is both ignorant and arrogant, however, can be most problematic if not handled properly. Cleft Chin, fortunately, was simply arrogant. His reading of me was so dead on that it never occurred to him that any other conclusion he might draw could be an error. He simply assumed that since something was common knowledge to the others in the village, it had to be known to me as well. Except, of course, it wasn't. I was, however, quite good when it came to guessing at things. That intuition had served me well on any number of occasions, and I suspected I was going to be able to have it serve me again in this case.
So how do you plan to do it?
Why would I tell you that? Why would I tell you how I intend to bring down...
And this was where I began my conjectures.
That notorious criminal organization, the Fork Tongue, and their foot soldiers, the Aeneas Ninja.
All he did was scowl, more at my lack of being forthcoming, which led me to conclude that my guess was accurate.
Granted, the reward being offered by the supreme ruler of this land, the honorable, the divine, the lordly presence over
the
all...
The Imperial, yes. If there is one habit I cannot tolerate, it is this tendency to place endless honorifics before his title. Just say the Imperial and be done with it.
The Imperial has set out a reward for the destruction of the Aeneas Ninja and presumably the Forked Tongue as well.
I know that. You're telling me things I already know. What I want to know is, to earn the 10 million yen, what are you going to do? How are you going to go about it?
I had no idea what a yang was, or how much it was worth, and whether 10 million was truly a significant amount. Although it certainly sounded impressive to me. The one thing I did not know, however, was this someone trying to mooch their way into an ideal situation.
You still haven't explained to me why I should possibly cut you in.
You've no reason to. I do not seek riches. I find my wealth in the simple things, in the shining of the sun, in the rising of the moon.
Spare me. You just want something. Somebody always wants something. What sort of deal are you endeavoring to cut with me here?
He entered the hut with visible effort. Before I could say or do anything, his hand lashed out and encompassed my throat.
These are good and gentle people. They neither want nor deserve trouble. If you are indeed intent to embark on this course of action, then for their sakes, for all our sakes, you had best succeed. That is all I have to say to you.
He held me that way a moment longer, as if he was going to add something to his pronouncement. And then, true to his word, he released me, adding a shove for good measure.
Did you give a lecture like this to Ali before he brought down upon himself whatever doom he did? Were you concerned his activities, whatever they were, would rebound to the detriment of your people?
Yes. Almost exactly the same lecture. And look how it turned out for him.
I stood there rubbing my throat. That had been wholly unexpected and somewhat painful. It was also informative and wildly tempting. There had been any number of times I had allowed my innate greed and love of fortune get me into some sort of dire predicament. One would have thought that I'd learned by that point that such endeavors never come to a good end. Unfortunately, such was not the case. Given the opportunity, would I turn around and make the exact same mistake? Absolutely.
A reward. 10 million yen. The Imperia.
I prepared for my departure with renewed vigor. Matters of vengeance were of little interest to me. Matters of honor were of even less moment. But matters of personal aggrandizement and benefit were definitely more than enough to intrigue me. I wasn't committing myself to anything, surely. I could contemplate an action without necessarily seeing it through. I could explore this concept, find out as much as I could about this Forked Tongue, learn how their organization was set up, and perhaps discover a weak point that I could exploit. I was, after all, an outsider, and sometimes a particular situation that mystified or frustrated those who were close to it could be easily resolved by a fresh outlook. But I had to find this Imperia, this ruler of all Chinpan. As it turned out, that wasn't so much of a chore at all. child's play, in fact. To be specific, I asked the children who were playing out in the center of the village.
Where would one find the Imperia?
Taikyo, in the Great Palace.
Well, that seemed reasonably straightforward. A small bit of further probing divined from the older children the fact that Taikyo was fairly easy to get to, at least from a directional point of view. One went to the main intersection of the small path out of town with the main road, and then went due west. Simple enough. Keep my back to the sun during the day, ride toward it as the day waned. As it turned out, I wasn't going to have to walk. Kitchen's family, with great pomp and display, provided me with a horse. It was one of the beasts that the thugs who had come to our village and wound up as fertilizer had been riding. I knew there was a small element of risk, since the animal might be recognized by the people who had dispatched those musclemen in the first place. But the horse itself was fairly nondescript, with no markings or brands upon it that I could see. So it was worth the minimal gamble in order to spare me limping all the way to Tokyo. And so, that very morning, I set out. I had transformed Ali's unique sword into the center staff of a bindle, keeping it wrapped in its concealing cloth and attaching a sack at the end that contained my belongings. The people of House Bayou lined the streets to see me off. It was quite an overt demonstration for a group of people that generally tended to remain low-key. It made my heart swell with pride, so much so that it was an effort for me to remind myself that my initial impulse had been to fool them completely. For that matter, it remained my backup plan. Till, as I set out, I could feel the smoldering gaze of Clef Chin burning upon me for the entirety of my departure, and for much of the time thereafter. The first few days of my sojourn passed rather unremarkably. I encountered a few travelers who were heading in the direction opposite to mine. They stared at me as they approached and continued to watch me silently as we passed each other. It was natural for them to have that sort of reaction. I was, after all, like nothing they'd ever seen. A round-eyed individual wearing the apparel of local farmers, with one of those wide flat hats upon my head to ward off the sun. The road ran roughly parallel to the river. This was a very clever bit of design, for it simplified the journey tremendously. If my water skins were getting low, I would get off the road, walk over to the river, and refill them. The villagers had provided me with various simple foodstuffs that traveled well. Rice, mostly. Lots of rice. Lots and lots of rice. I couldn't recall a time when I had been better or more thoroughly armed, which was an impressive achievement considering I was someone who tried to avoid combat whenever humanly possible. The two sai were tucked into the wide sash I wore as a belt. My bastard sword was strapped to my back, as always, and my walking staff was lashed to the right side of the horse's saddle. The bird's head sword hung on the saddle's left side. I shied away from the occasional inns I passed, having no idea of the reception I would receive along the way. Instead, when night approached, I would hie myself over to the nearby forest, which also seemed to run the length of my sojourn, and there, amidst the bamboo trees, I would find rest and an uneasy form of peace. On the road to Taikyo, I had a recurring dream that was particularly troublesome for me. I would see the bird's head sword that I was carrying with me. It was whirling through the air at a formidable speed, like a spinning scythe. And there was a light, blinding, brilliant. I saw myself trying to shield my eyes, and everything was silent around me. There was ash, ash everywhere, and some sort of outline against a wall. But I couldn't make out what it was. And Morden was there, shaking his head sadly and looking at me in a most pitying manner. The dream would dissolve like paper on water, and try as I might to retrieve it and divine what it was trying to tell me, I was unable to do so. I was another day or two's ride from Taikyo, according to one of the passers-by with whom I checked, and had settled into the forest for the evening. The forest was thinning out, and I wasn't sure how much longer I was going to be able to avail myself of its friendly shelters. The unfortunate problem was, I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do once I reached my destination. I couldn't very well just wander about the city trying to find the Aeneas ninjas or the Fork Tong. I knew very little about the former and virtually nothing about the latter. They, on the other hand, might well have eyes and ears on every street corner of the city, and unguarded queries about them could cause me to have an arrow in my chest or a dagger slip between my ribs without warning. The key to my quandary might well lie with this Imperia that Clef Chin had mentioned. But if this fellow were truly the leader of the entire country, what possible reason would he have to see me? As I lay on my back, staring at the sky, a plan began to bubble within my brain. Until this point, I considered my obvious foreign appearance as a handicap. Now I was starting to realize that it could in fact be a benefit. During my stay in the court of King Ronsible, there had been any number of occasions where ambassadors had shown up, representing some damn king or monarch or warlord or other. They would come bearing greetings and say nice words of alliance or obedience, and would be in turn treated with deference and as honored guests. There was no reason in the world I couldn't be dealt with in a like manner. Considering the stares I was continuing to get from what the people of Haos Bayou had told me, foreigners in this land were more or less unknown. So if I said that I was representing a far-off king who wanted to establish ties with the Imperium of Chinpan, who was there to say nay? It wasn't as if I was showing up to declare war. Such messengers occasionally came to bad ends, with their heads on pikes while their hands, genitals, and entrails were shipped back from whence they came with a note that said, "You want war? You've got war," or something to that effect. But me, I was simply an arriving visitor, showing due deference. Granted, if the Imperial was a complete madman, he might have me gutted just because he didn't like my eyes. So there was a calculated risk involved, but it was one I was willing to take, for the reward seemed promising. And also, as much as I wanted to deny it, I really did want to try and find a way to avenge Ali's death. During my travels, the more I dwelt upon it, the more I thought of all the things he might have been able to teach me. I wasn't just thinking of combat, although that was certainly a consideration. There was also the matter of my state of mind. If he could have shown me a way to ease the constant frustration and sense of gloom from my being, he would have earned my eternal gratitude and devotion. And those who had deprived me of him were going to pay. Somehow. As I lay in the bamboo forest, pondering the imponderables of my life and dozing as I did so, I heard some curious noises out by the road. And another sound as well, one that instantly snapped me full to wakefulness.
Mordant.
It didn't seem possible. I'd seen him in my dreams and knew all too well the chance that they gave hints of things to come. But the notion that he was really, truly here. And if that was the case, could Cherie be with him? I realized at that moment that in many ways my heart had not been beating for quite some time. But the merest chance that Cherie might be around caused it to jump and flutter and pound with newfound vigor against my ribs. Gods, embarking upon missions of vengeance, albeit with the added incentive of a reward. Feeling such passion for a woman who had abandoned me that I was almost giddy at the prospect of seeing her again. What had happened to me? What mad land had I entered? It was as if I'd entered a land that was trying to make me less than I was. Less. Or perhaps more. Opting for stealth over speed, I quickly made my way through the forest to the edge, which came right up to the road. It was a moonless night, and I managed to keep myself adroitly concealed within the shadowed bamboo woods as I peered out and saw something exceedingly strange. There was an assortment of about half a dozen carts lined up, having come to a halt upon the road. Each was being pulled by a broken-down-looking horse, a more pathetic collection of nags I had never seen. The cages had barred sides, and I could see that each had some sort of animal pacing back and forth. They were a bizarre assortment. One appeared to be some sort of bear, but it was large and round, with black and white fur, looking more like an oversized raccoon than anything truly ursine. There was another creature I thought could be something I'd once seen drawings of, called a monkey. It was bouncing around like an insane two-year-old child and was covered with a thick coat of golden fur. A most curious creature in many ways, it seemed almost human. Another odd animal was curled up almost into a ball, and its entire skin seemed to be composed of overlapping scales. There was also a large bird, an eagle I was reasonably sure, which was dark brown with a patch of golden feathers on its back. It was on a perch, stretching its wings and cawing. There was also the largest cat I had ever seen. In my life, I had encountered occasional oversized felines wandering the forests, but this was like nothing I had ever experienced. It appeared to be at least 6 feet from fearsome maul to whipping tail, perhaps longer. Even in the dimness of the night, I could see its fur was orange with black stripes winding around its body. The most important cage, however, was the one occupied by Mordant. Presuming it was Mordant, of course. It could simply have been any drabbit, although it certainly bore a striking resemblance to him. He was on a perch similar to the one the eagle was on, the difference being there was a thin but sturdy chain anchoring him to it. His neck was fully extended. The reason for his upset, beyond the fact that he was imprisoned, was immediately evident. There was a slim young man there, clearly in the process of trying to free Morton from his cage. He was crouched on the side of the cage, perched on it bat-like, and he'd clearly been trying to pry a thick padlock off the gate with a curved bar. Clearly, the caravan had been moving, and he clambered aboard the cage, trying to bust open the lock and free Morton with no one the wiser. But obviously, someone had noticed him. The young man had his black hair tied up in the customary topknot. He was dressed entirely in black, wearing a loose-fitting jacket and equally loose pantaloons. His face was round and looked to be gentle by nature, but now it was twisted in a fierce and defiant expression, shouting rapidly at the men who were advancing on him. And there was quite a few men, close to a dozen, and they were coming in from all sides. It was all painfully clear what was transpiring. This was some sort of traveling circus, and the young fellow had, for reasons of his own, been endeavoring to free Morton from it. Presuming it was Morton, my natural instinct, of course, was to refrain from risking myself. Suddenly, the small dragon's head whipped around, and even from the distance I was standing, I could see his nostrils flaring. He was sniffing the air. It was Morton, all right. And if I was going to find out how in the world he had come to be in Chimpan, and where Cherie might be, I was going to have to do something to get him out of there myself. Sticking to the lengthy shadows, keeping low, I moved toward the halted caravan, even as the angry circus men surged forward and grabbed the young man off the cage, holding Morton prisoner. The young man, however, was not prepared to go quietly. Somehow he managed to shake free and was standing several feet away from the circus men. The assortment of fearsome, burly men advanced on him, and suddenly he was in motion. His hands and feet moved with such speed that it was impossible for me to follow. As they grabbed for him, he deftly dodged between each thrust, finding key points such as the crotch or throat to strike with devastating kicks and powerful forward thrusts of his fingers. It was amazing how quickly opponents were going down. He was doing well, but there were just too many of them. Sooner or later, they were going to bring him down and very likely beat him to a bloody pulp. His fate didn't concern me too much, but Morton's was definitely of interest. While the athletic young man kept everyone else busy, I made my way around to the rear of the cart. The big cat looked at me with interest as I approached his cage. He raised his head, and I slid open one of the hidden compartments in my staff. Studying the padlock, I was immediately able to withdraw the proper lockpick for the job from the assortment I maintained in there for just such situations. The huge cat completely changed its attitude. It leapt out of the cage and hit the ground, landing lightly despite its bulk. It fixed its gaze on me, its yellow eyes narrowing, and then it opened its maw and bared a set of teeth that could have torn me to bits. It was at that moment I suddenly concluded this might not have been one of my brightest ideas. I had thought of the beast as primarily a means of a large distraction. Because it looked so placid, I didn't consider it a serious danger. Seeing it out, I realized I'd woefully miscalculated. I backed up, starting to reach for my sword, and realized with a sinking heart that I would not be able to pull it clear from the scabbard before the cat was upon me. The shouts instantly captured the great beast's attention. Whatever the animal's opinion of me, I was far too recent an acquaintance to sustain its full interest. Instead, its fierce brain remembered its captors. The ones who had captured it and kept it prisoner for who knew how long. There was obviously no love lost in that relationship. It might even have been that its keepers were abusive to it during its captivity. If that was the case, forgive and forget was most definitely not in the beast's philosophy. The cat sprang. There had to be a distance of 20 feet between us and the cat's prey, and the animal covered it in one powerful leap. It landed squarely on the back of one of its keepers. The most he was able to accomplish in terms of self-defense was to bring up his arms and try to ward the animal off. This worked not at all as the great cat drove him to the ground. It sank its huge teeth into the man's face. The circus men were running as fast as they could. Several noticed me in advance, drawing daggers which they brandished fearsomely. The time for subtlety was over. I yanked out my bastard sword, turned and smashed open the nearest padlock. The men froze as the huge black and white bear lumbered to freedom. I waited for it, like its formidable cousin, to rear its feet and launch an unstoppable attack. The creature's bulk was gargantuan. It could probably flatten anyone there. The bear glanced left and right, then promptly waddled off toward the forest. That was all the men needed in way of incentive to charge me. I swung the heavy blade at another lock, breaking this one as well. The monkey leaped out of his cage and then bounded toward its erstwhile captors with the clear intent of killing them. One wouldn't have thought a monkey to be all that much of a threat, but between the surprising strength it displayed and the limpidness of its moves as it scrambled all over its victims, it was a holy terror. Within minutes, I had all the beasts but Morden free, which was nicely ironic, considering he was the only one I was generally interested in. Throughout the rest of the camp, people were running about like lunatics, trying to stay ahead of the great cat, or in the vain endeavor to recapture some of the animals. Neither goal was being achieved. The young man and Morden had been forgotten as the larger creatures were being dealt with. I made my way over there quickly to see the young man with a dagger jammed into the padlock, trying futilely to pick it. I gave him high marks for effort, but he clearly had no idea what he was doing. He saw me coming, yanked the dagger out of the lock, and struck a defensive pose. At the same time, his brow furrowed as he studied my face, obviously unsure what to make of me.
Mitsu, it's all right. He's a friend, in a very broad sense of the word.
Back away. The young man yanked open the door. I heard an outraged shout from behind me and whirled in time to see two of the circus men charging us, waving knives. I readied my sword, not eager for a fight, but not in a position to back away from it. I needn't have concerned myself. Mitsu somersaulted through the air as if he were being hoisted on strings and landed squarely with one foot in each of the men's faces. They went down and Mitsu ricocheted off them and found himself face to face with the great cat. Suddenly, Morden swept forward, perching upon Mitsu's shoulder. His head was extended all the way forward on his slim neck. The cat's tail twitched, then pointed straight outward, its gaze never leaving Morden. Then, slowly, the tail drooped down, relaxing. It turned its back to us and went off in search of other prey.
Let's get out of here. It may change its mind.
What did you say to it?
It doesn't translate.
I had 100 questions, but they could all wait till we made it back into the woods. A short distance ahead of us, I heard my horse whinnying. I didn't like the sound of that at all. There was every possibility that the great cat had doubled back ahead of us somehow and was in the process of devouring my steed. But when we drew near, I almost had to smile upon discovering the black and white bear seated contentedly on the ground, chewing on a bamboo tree, leaves, wood, and all. My horse was standing nearby, watching with obvious confusion. The bear had startled it. However, once it was clearly established as being no threat, the horse was content to watch it devour the tree at a leisurely clip.
I think we'd best get out of here.
I hadn't been doing much traveling at night, and since I didn't dare head back down toward the road for guidance, I wasn't entirely certain which way to go.
Where are you headed?
Take your...
It's that way. Come, we'll bring you.
No, you won't.
It was the first time I'd heard Mitsu speak in something vaguely approaching normal conversational tone. Morden was positioned on Mitsu's shoulder. Now he hopped off and landed on a branch so he could face Mitsu more easily.
We've discussed this, Mitsu.
Listening to you telling me what I should do isn't a discussion.
Excuse me, I would love to hear the continuation of this discussion, provided it wasn't boring me to death. I'd like to get going before those fools come after us and make our lives more difficult than they need to be. Mordant, you said you knew the way.
Yes. Are you coming, Mitsu?
No.
Fine. I propose this way.
I climbed astride my horse and we started off.
You're not just going to leave me here.
I can't force you to come. Stay if you want, come along if you want, head off in a different direction entirely. It's up to you.
Once more, we started in the direction of Tekyo. Or at least the direction as claimed by Mordant. I heard an impatient stomping behind us, and then Mitsu started following us.
Friend of yours?
Not exactly.
Don't take this the wrong way, but he reminds me a bit of a certain princess I used to know, insofar as his attitudes. Is he a prince?
No.
Well, too bad. With that kind of attitude, being royalty was his best bet for not getting the shite kicked out of him. But enough of him. Where is Shuri? Is she with you?
I was doing my best to keep excitement out of my voice. Unfortunately, I don't think I was all that successful.
You miss her, don't you?
No, I don't miss her. I'm just intensely curious to know. For God's sakes, Drabbit, I did experience some adventures with the woman. Naturally, I'm interested to know how things turned out. This quest you went on with her, has she come here because of it? Is she in Tekyo? How much of a coincidence would that be, eh? Sometimes things come together, Morden. You don't think they will, but they do. It almost makes you believe
it. She's not here, apropos. The quest is over.
Over? Well, how went it then? Successful?
I wanted to hear that it wasn't, of course. I wanted to hear that that fool weaver Rex Regis had led them to disaster and humiliation. Wouldn't that be glorious?
Well, not to sound immodest, but, we saved the world.
How now? You did what? Save the what?
The world. In its entirety. Surely you must have noticed.
Noticed? How would I have noticed?
Well, the final battle, apropos. It was grand on an epic scale. Or epic on a grand scale, take your pick. I won't bore you with the details.
Thus earning my undying gratitude.
But the bottom line is that Rex, Shuri, the others and I faced odds beyond imagining. We didn't all make it, but those of us who did will be able to tell our grandchildren about the day and night of great darkness when living lightning nearly consumed the planet.
As you described it, memories flooded back to me.
I remember that night, that day and that night. It seemed endless. Are you saying that you are somehow responsible for that?
Responsible for the storms themselves? No. Responsible for stopping them, though. You see, a dark magic user employed ancient tomes to... Oh, I forgot. You don't care about such things.
Not when there are other things to care about. You said you didn't all make it. Does that mean Shuri...
Oh! Shuri, dead. No. More lives than a cat, that one. No, she and Rex made it through, as did I. Not that I bonded in the same way with Rex as Shuri did, I'm rather relieved to say. He would probably be relieved as well.
What are you going on about now? What bonded? What are you...
Well, apropos...
He stopped and clung to a tree trunk, wrapping himself around it and actually looking slightly chagrined.
Oh... Do you not comprehend, then, about Rex and Shuri?
I have no idea what you're... They're together. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying, yes.
How together?
They are wedded, apropos. I was there for the ceremony.
I felt a slow numbness spreading through me. But fortunately, I was on horseback, and so it was less apparent. Outwardly, my demeanor did not change at all. Or at least, I was trying to make sure it stayed that way.
I see. Wedded. Well, then it's probably for the best.
Apropos, are you quite all right?
Yes, I'm fine. This is not unexpected, Morton.
I assured him, even as I felt my heart crumbling. Foolish heart. As if I'd ever had a chance with her. As if I'd ever let her know I had the slightest interest in her.
It is most usual for people who share remarkably dangerous adventures to form strong, even unassailable bonds. Their marriage is simply a natural outgrowth of that bonding.
You and Cherie shared remarkably dangerous adventures. Are you saying that you two were...
Obviously not. Let us keep in mind the adventures we shared, neither of us entered willingly. I was dragooned into them, and she wanted to kill me much of the time. Hardly any sort of foundation upon which to build a long-term relationship. Besides, you should know by now that I'm not exactly like other men. What serves the purposes of others, lesser mortals, cannot hope to stand up to my requirements.
He didn't appear to have the faintest idea what I was talking about. That was quite all right. I shared the same sense of quandary.
But how did you happen to come here and wind up in a cage in that traveling circus?
The circumstances were curious.
Morton glanced at Mitsu. Perhaps he thought I didn't notice the look, but it's difficult to hide body language when one's head is designed to unconsciously have one's tongue flick in the direction one is contemplating.
And none of your business, really. Frankly, given your repeated disdain for hearing other people's tales, I'm almost surprised you'd even ask.
I'm a surprising individual. What about him? Can he be trusted?
Him? Oh, yes. He can be annoying at times, but he is, on the whole, trustworthy.
Is that the case?
I reined up and turned to look at Mitsu, who had been following us in that sullen manner that only young boys can possess.
Do you not trust Mordant?
When you get to know me better, you will come to understand that I don't trust anyone.
I have no interest in getting to know you better.
Really? Perhaps you haven't been paying attention, but if it weren't for me, those circus folk would have torn you apart. I'm the one who released the animals to distract them. I'm the one who got Mordant out of his cell. Considering all of that, I'd show a bit more gratitude if I were you.
He looked about to reply, but then exchanged a silent look with Mordant. Then he drew himself up stiffly, slapped his hands to either side of his legs, and bowed deeply at the waist.
I am in your debt. You shall not find me stinting in my endeavors to acknowledge and honor that debt.
Thank you. That means a great deal.
Does it?
Of course not. Now then, let's be on our way.
There were many more things I could have asked Morton. Pressed him on the question of how he'd wound up in Chimpan or attracted the attention of this Mitsu person. But asking about Cherie and discovering the direction her life had gone somehow left me with little interest, or even less interest than I would usually have had in such matters. I realized I just hadn't been prepared for that aspect of my life to be ended so completely. Cherie had come into my life when I was quite young, when my childhood friend Tacit and I had rescued her from some angry villagers intent on burning her to cinders. Since then, even when she had not been with me physically, she had been in my dreams, in the periphery of my existence in some way, shape, or form. But she hadn't been in my dreams lately. Indeed, not for quite some time. And now I was understanding why. It was because she was, for good and all, a thing of my past. And I apparently wasn't quite ready for that. Nevertheless, it had happened whether I was ready or not.
Why are you going to take you? You never said.
There was a man I knew, a good man. He was killed. I'd go to seek justice for him.
Really? Have you ever sought justice for someone before?
Once, for my mother. It didn't work out particularly well and underscored for me the futility of such endeavors.
And yet you do it anyway.
Yes.
Why?
Because there is no idea that exists that is so foolish that it can't be embarked upon twice. Cherie.
What? What did you just say?
I was just wondering if she's happy, in your opinion.
Yes. I don't think I've ever seen an individual quite as happy as she was.
Ah. Happy then?
Very much so.
I wonder what that's like, being happy.
I'll say this for Tekio. It wasn't made of bamboo. It was easily the largest city I had ever been in. Bigger than anything I might have imagined. Here I had thought that I had encountered some sort of primitive culture, and instead the construction of the city indicated a civilization far older than any I had known. For starters, all the roads were paved. Many of the buildings were raised above the ground on platforms of rammed earth, brick or dirt. According to Mitsu, who was obviously familiar with the city, but reluctant to discuss it in detail, it was from a time before the roads were paved, in order to keep the buildings above the mud and dirt. I marveled at the architecture, with many ornately curved roofs on the larger buildings, supported by structures of wooden beams, to provide bracing in the event of an earthquake, I was told. That was a bit of news I could have done without. Taikyo was also divided in terms of economic strata. The domiciles of the richer, more elite citizens were all clustered in one section and had the aforementioned remarkable lavish style of design. But as we moved to the city, we found other sections that were far less so. The fish market, for example. It was easily the busiest and most thriving area of the city, understandably since the majority of the populace reputedly subsisted almost entirely on a diet of fish. The fish market was situated on either side of a massive river that carved straight through the middle of the city. Large curved bridges traversed the river, and they were quite crowded with people coming and going from the market. This made the bridges no different from the rest of the city, which seemed to be packed from one end to the other with humanity. There were more people there than I'd ever seen in one place in my life, and that included the royal joust back in Asteria. Fortunately enough, everyone seemed far too caught up in their own interests to pay much attention to us. That was something of a feat considering the odd little group we were. Drabbits were still not exactly commonplace features to see, and certainly my features marked me as something completely out of the ordinary. I still had my cloak, though, and I had pulled it out of my bundle before we'd entered the city. I draped it around my shoulders and brought my hood up, deftly serving to obscure my face. Morton then took a position beneath the cloak, clinging onto my bag and flattening himself so that at the most, I looked as if I had a small humpback. Humpbacks were also not common, but I suspected one saw them more frequently than tiny dragons or men with round eyes in these parts. By this point, I had dismounted and was simply walking through the streets, holding the horse firmly by the reins and guiding it through the crowds. At least people got out of our way, which was a plus, although many of them gave us slightly annoyed looks at having to step aside. In the marketplace, I found a fellow who was selling sword belts, the kind that had the latches that would support the sword that Ali had wielded. I was getting uncomfortable with the notion of keeping it attached to the horse, so I purchased a belt, lashed it around me, pulled the sword out of its place on the horse, and attached it. It was the first time that Mitsu had seen the weapon.
That is an impressive-looking weapon.
Thank you. It's an heirloom.
I pulled my walking staff from its place on the other side of the horse. Despite the fact that it was a necessary device to compensate for my lameness, by that point in my life, I actually found that I derived a measure of comfort, even security, from it. Thus outfitted, we continued on our way. The domiciles in the fishing district, as opposed to the richer sections of the town, were packed in almost one atop the other.
In many parts of the city, families live 7 or 8 to a single room.
I found this appalling and couldn't help but wonder at the conditions of the city which required so many people to live so close together. But then I began to understand, for as we glided through the fish market, I saw in the distance the single largest structure in the entirety of Taikyo. Hell, for all I knew, it was the single largest structure in the entirety of the world. It was a sprawling castle sitting atop what I could only describe as a small mountain. Great stone pillars rose up, supporting the sprawling curved roof composed of overlapping tiles and, ironically, a series of twisting, sinewy statues of dragons that bore a passing resemblance to the creature hitching a ride on my back. The palace was separated from the rest of the city by a series of moats. It loomed there, sending out a sense of majesty and superiority.
That I take to be the residence of the Imperia.
I turned to discover that Mitsu was gone.
Now what the hell?
Problem?
Morton's voice came from beneath my cloak.
Your fool friend is gone. Mitsu!
Odd. That's not like him to wander off.
Well, he did it anyway. Mitsu!
Yes?
I turned to find him standing there, looking quite calm.
Where did you get off to?
Nowhere. You're the one who wandered away from me.
I started to protest that I had wandered nowhere, but quickly decided it wasn't worth the effort.
That castle, that's where the Imperia resides?
Yes.
Mitsu was not forthcoming with any details.
All right, I just had to present myself to the Imperia and we'll see what I can learn.
Wait. Do you seriously think you're going to be able to just walk up to the Imperia? It's impossible.
Why impossible?
To begin with, the Imperia only sees the public 2 days a year.
2 days? And what 2 days would those be?
The New Year and his birthday.
When?
Neither of which is any time soon.
But I'm not a citizen. I will be presenting myself as a representative of a far-off unknown land.
Are you?
Prove that I'm not.
It does not matter. All that your status would guarantee you is a quick death.
A quick death? Why?
You don't understand. The Imperio is not simply a mortal man.
He's not?
Well, he thinks he's not. The Imperio is designated by the gods. He is divine. He is holy. He is all-knowing. And I am quite sure that your race and the land from which you come is completely unknown to him.
So?
So, are you not paying attention? One cannot be all-knowing and be faced with the unknown both at the same time.
Ah.
Now you understand?
Yes. If there is physical proof of someone or something that the Imperial doesn't know about, then his divine all-knowing status is challenged. He cannot tolerate any such challenge. So what he would be obliged to do is eliminate that which is challenging him. But wouldn't he be interested in finding out about that which is new to him?
Of course not. Because by definition...
He already knows about it. And if he doesn't know about it, then it must not exist. So if it does exist, it behooves him to make certain it stops existing.
Precisely. Why was it so necessary for you to speak directly with the Imperial anyway?
Because I want to find a way to help him destroy the Forked Tongue.
Ah,
the Forked Tongue. You are familiar with them, are you?
Not really, but I know enough.
And what do you know?
That they are some sort of criminal organization, and they work in tandem with a group calling themselves the Aeneas Ninjas. The group that was responsible for killing my teacher.
I see. And how do you propose to destroy this Forked Tongue and the Aeneas Ninjas?
I'm not sure yet. I need more information about them. Mitsu, you seem a knowledgeable sort.
Do I?
What can you tell me?
That if you meddle with organizations such as those whose names you are so unwisely bandying about, you will die.
Sooner or later, I'll die anyway. So what difference does it make?
All the difference in the world if you desire sooner to become later.
Trouble.
Once again, it was Morden who had spoken from concealment.
Ease up on your claws, if you don't mind. What trouble? What are you talking about?
Not sure. I just smell it. Let's go.
This is ridiculous.
Let's go!
I could feel the claws prickling at my skin once more. How in the world Morden could possibly smell trouble, I hadn't a clue. All I could smell was fish.
There!
Mitsu didn't point, obviously not wanting to draw attention, but I followed the young man's glance and saw what he was indicating. I recognized them instantly. Not them specifically, but their mode of dress, the colors they wore, which were identical to that of the three thugs who had ridden into the small village of Hounds Bayou with the intention of causing trouble, right before Chip Pan Ali had caused them more problems than they could have ever imagined. There were two of them. They were not taking their eyes off us as we made our way through the market.
We have a problem.
It seemed as if the people in the crowd sensed that these men meant trouble and tried to get out of their way as quickly as they could.
You know them?
They work for the Skanky crime family. Well, if you're interested in finding out about the Forked Tongue, they would certainly be the ones who tell you what you wish to know.
They're with the Forked Tongue as well.
You don't seem to understand. Everyone of criminal intent in this city is part of the Forked Tongue. Why do you think the Imperial despises them so? Because they're organized. Enemies who are splintered are far more easily handled than enemies who are united.
Words of wisdom. I shall carry them with me for many years. Provided we manage to survive the next few minutes.
Why are they coming after you?
I don't know. For all I know, they're coming after you.
Me? What did I ever do to the Skanky family?
Since I really don't have any clue as to who they are, I'd have no way of answering that, would I? For all I know, you raped and murdered a favored daughter.
Even as I spoke, I glanced around desperately to see if there was a way out.
Come,
I headed off to the left, but they were coming from that direction as well. I turned and saw that a fourth possible means of retreat had also been cut off.
What's happening?
We have a problem.
The advancing men, as if by unspoken cue, suddenly unsheathed their swords.
We have a major problem.
Do you need me to intercede?
No, I need you to grow about 20 feet in length and be able to blast fire out of your mouth.
I'll work on it.
The crowd was melting away around us, and I suddenly felt extremely vulnerable as a space cleared in every direction. No one wanted to interfere or get involved.
Gentlemen, may I be of assistance?
They came in quickly, their swords swinging. I didn't know where to look first. I was totally paralyzed. No clue what to do. Mitsu, on the other hand, did not hesitate. He leaped forward, angling his body as he went, and slid between the legs of the foremost attackers. He brought his legs up fast and slammed them into the crotch of his opponent. The man doubled over, losing his grip on his sword as he did so. Mitsu arched his back and snapped up to his feet, plucking the sword out of the air as it fell. He whipped it back and forth with amazing speed, judging its heft, and instantly deflected the thrust of the next attacker. And then he was gone. Just like that, he darted between two of the attackers and vanished from the scene, leaving me on my own. I had to give him credit. I hadn't expected actions quite that craven. It was almost worthy of me. If I weren't seized with the desire to cut Mitsu into shreds at that moment, I'd actually have admired him for his self-centeredness. Whatever vain hope I had that perhaps these bullies were after Mitsu evaporated because none of them went after him. Instead, their full attention was still focused upon me. I backed up and suddenly found myself up against a wall.
Any time now would be useful.
And the men froze where they were, their eyes widened, their faces turning ashen, and Morden angled toward them. They swept at him with their swords, but Morden danced between the flashing blades with dazzling agility, and then... His claws raked across their faces. Suddenly, I felt a tug at my hip. I turned just in time to get an elbow in the face. And saw that one of the behemoths had gotten close enough to try and yank the bird's head sword from its scabbard. Apparently, it wasn't coming out easily, and the pull was sufficient to get my attention. Unfortunately, my attention in turn had gotten me the aforementioned elbow. I sagged against the wall even as I snapped out the blade at the end of my staff and swung it. He wasn't expecting it, and the blade cut across his chest, glancing off the ribcage, leaving a trail of torn cloth and blood in its wake. He staggered, and I gripped the tachi sword and yanked. It came free of the scabbard, and my attacker's eyes widened as he stepped back, bringing his own blade to bear, but not looking as if he was happy to do so. It was the first time I wielded the blade in combat. I continued to be amazed by the lack of weight. If I had known better, I'd have thought I was holding nothing at all. I brought the sword back, prepared to defend myself as best I could.
I know you're with the Skanki family, but what the hell do you want?
We operate under the orders of the Great Ho. The Ho gives us orders and we obey. It is not for you to ask or for us to explain ourselves to you. It is for you to lay down your life without question.
Oh, really? Well, if you think I'm just going to roll over at the say-so of some Skanki Ho, you can just forget it.
Obviously, that wasn't the thing to say to placate them. They came in fast, watching the sword warily, which was why, naturally, I used my walking staff. Whipping the sword to one side, I lunged to my left, my strong side, and used the staff as a cudgel to bat the nearest sword out of the way. For about a second, I was in the clear. There was no way with the lack of foot speed that I'd be able to get away, but I could even the odds in terms of balance. My lunge had taken me right next to the stand filled with some sort of fish. Dozens of small, gray-scaled bodies lying in a massive pile. With a quick thrust, I overturned the stand and the fish spilled out everywhere onto the ground. The Skanki musclemen were barreling toward me far too quickly to stop. And boy did they hit the fish. Their feet going up from under them, and with outraged shouts, they skidded to the ground. I slammed the walking staff into the ground and hopped forward, keeping my right leg tucked under and relying on my left foot and staff for balance. With my free hand, I brought the sword around, about to start slicing them up while demanding answers.
One side! Make way!
Just like that, the men of the Skanky family were gone. They bolted in all directions, leaving me standing there with my sword in my hand and a bewildered expression on my face. I gaped as I saw what were clearly several burly warriors shoving me two forward. They were wearing long, sweeping black robes, the type that I had learned were called kimonos, a far finer cloth than the rough-hewn material sported by the others. The black was accentuated by inner lines of white against the V-neck. Each warrior wore an additional garment atop the kimono, gray with straps across the chest and shoulder pieces that flared out, making the shoulders seem even wider than they were. The garments were belted at the middle and would have looked like skirts in the lower half, save that they were split at the legs. Mitsu was struggling mightily in their grasp, but this was a very different kind of opponent from what we'd been facing before. You could see it in their eyes. They were strong, well-trained, and likely capable of handling anything thrown their way. And anything certainly included a young man, no matter how much resistance he was putting up.
In the name of the Imperia, surrender! Surrender immediately! Surrender completely!
Yes, I get it. There's a degree of surrendering involved. We surrender, don't we? Conveying to Mitsu that I was somewhat irked over the desertion. One of them strode forward, kicking the fish to one side to get them out of his way, and shoved my hood back to get a better look at me.
What are you? What are you that speaks with such an odd accent and has such abnormal features?
Abnormal features? I reached up and touched my face. Oh, God, what has happened to me? What perverse enchantment? My face, my beautiful face. Not as beautiful as yours, of course, but fair to look upon nonetheless. What dark magic has inflicted itself upon me? It must have been him.
Him?
That man who claimed to be a magic user, who said he would put a curse upon me because he misliked the way I looked at his daughter. I never touched her, I swear. You have to believe me. I pawed at him, and he shoved me back. I must go and find him immediately. Thank you for drawing this horrific matter to my attention. I turned and started to bolt, and then one of his meaty hands clamped down upon my shoulder, immobilizing me. Problem, officer?
You have been brawling in the streets.
Now, what gives you that idea?
Witnesses! And the blood on your shirt.
I cut myself.
I see no cut.
It happened days ago.
This blood is fresh.
I'm a slow bleeder? All right, do you want the truth? It wasn't my normal style, but I figured I didn't have much to lose. The truth is we were attacked by the members of the Skanky family. I don't know why.
Who does? Your accent remains strange. I'm asking you, who knows why you were attacked?
And I'm telling you, who knows why?
Who knows why?
Ho.
Ho.
No, ho.
Who's ho?
Ho is who.
Who is who?
No, ho is who.
No! No!
In retrospect, all things considered, I suppose I couldn't blame him for punching me flat. My lousy luck that in Chimpanese the word for who was the same as in my language. I lay on the ground, the sword still in my hand, but nearly forgotten as I tried to stop the world from spinning. Then a heavy pressure settled on my right forearm, immobilizing the hand holding the sword.
Did you not know that there was an edict from the Imperia that there is to be no public brawling?
No, I didn't, but thank you so much for bringing it to my attention. The problem is it wasn't my fault. We were the ones attacked.
Then you should have let yourselves be killed rather than disobey the edict.
Remember earlier how I spoke of the unassailability of someone who possesses both ignorance and arrogance? Such was the situation I was now faced with. I couldn't think of any response to the kind of thinking that encouraged being slaughtered instead of fighting back just to accommodate a rule I didn't know exist, made by a man I'd never met.
Sorry?
Do you know what the penalty is for disobeying an edict of the Imperia?
A severe scolding.
Death!
Clearly you haven't considered the full ramifications of a severe scolding. The mental scarring it can leave is far more damaging to... He appeared unimpressed. Instead, he gestured for Mitsu to be brought forward. Protesting, the young man was shoved in my direction and tumbled to the street next to me. The man standing on my arm, giving way to make room for him.
Thanks for the support.
You would have done the same.
You don't know that.
You deny it.
No, I'm just saying you don't know it.
The soldiers converged, each of them with his sword out. The blades glistened in the sun. I gripped the Toshi sword, knowing there was no place to go. My mind raced, trying to come up with anything, some brilliant lie that would buy us some time. The emissary from the foreign land routine would probably be a dead end, literally, if Mitsu's earlier comments were true. But it might be worth a try.
Wait!
Naturally, since no one was expecting an animal to speak, no one knew that he was the source of it. It came from above. Morden was doubtless perched upon a roof, keeping out of sight.
Don't kill her, you fools! She's the princess!
The huge soldiers froze in position, looking around for both the origin of the voice and also the alleged princess. Then the one who was gripping Mitsu firmly and painfully by the elbow looked down at him as if seeing him for the first time. He released Mitsu's arm as if it were on fire and immediately prostrated himself upon the ground.
Highness!
The others promptly followed suit, and Mitsu reached up and released his hair from the top knot. The black hair cascaded down to shoulder length. Long and luxurious, and suddenly there was no doubt at all that this was a female, and from the arrogant look on her face, a royal one at that. In a heartbeat, everyone in the fish market was on the ground except for me. I was gaping at her.
Divinity, in failing to recognize you and treating you in such a fashion, I have disgraced my good offices, my family, and my ancestors going back 5 generations.
Yes, you have. You should kill yourself immediately. I was joking.
My mistake. Divinity, we are under the strictest orders imaginable. Your absence from the palace has been of great concern to your godly father, and he has commanded us that if we are to come upon you, we are to return you to the palace immediately, whether it is what you desire or not.
Oh, very well. This is all your fault. I didn't want to come back here. But no, you insisted we had to come. Let it be on your scaly head, then.
I, of course, was the only person in the place who knew whom she was addressing.
You realize I could have you executed on the spot for gazing upon my godly countenance.
It's a bit late in the game for that. I have been staring at it for quite some time.
Yes, you're probably right. Fine, then. You have enough trouble walking anyway without having to concern yourself about not being able to watch where you're going.
You're too considerate, Divinity.
Yes, I know.
She was oblivious to sarcasm. I found that annoying. Generally, my sarcasm was more obvious than that. I might well have been losing my edge.
Get your horse. Let's go to the palace.
Us? You would bring this individual to the palace?
This individual brought me safely back to the city and fought to protect me from assassins. He is deserving of the highest honors we can provide him. He comes with us, and his person is to be considered sacrosanct.
Divinity, I...
Sacrosanct. Do you all understand?
Yes, Divinity.
Her comments caught me off guard, and she looked at me with a raised eyebrow and an imperious manner that seemed to say, "See? It would serve you better to be my friend than my enemy."
Go get your horse and let's go. We might as well get this over with. I'm sure my father just cannot wait to see me.
She took a couple of delicate steps towards the dead soldier.
Idiot.
When I'd been a younger man, I'd spent an inordinate amount of time with a borderline insane princess named Entropy. The Princess Mitsu clearly could have given her a run for her money. The best thing I could say about her was that she hadn't tried to set fire to anything. Then again, the day was young. As insane as Princess Entropy had been, her father, King Runcible, had been a fairly harmless individual. His main sins were those of omission rather than commission. Unless, of course, one counted his throwing me in a dungeon. Then again, considering that doing so had been a mercy as compared with the endeavors to kill me that so many others had undertaken, Runcible's actions were positively benign. I was hoping that the Imperia would fall into the same category. That hope lasted for exactly as long as it took to meet him. The soldiers were apparently members of some sort of warrior caste, collectively called the Hamunrai. They had been around for a few hundred years, rising up from an elite group of 7 and becoming one of the single most powerful classes in all of Chimpan. After a series of civil wars that had threatened to shred the entire class structure, the Hamunrai had wound up swearing fealty to the Imperia, and so it had been for 5 generations. All this was imparted to me by Mitsu in a very offhanded way as we strolled side by side to the palace. There were more Hamunrai standing guard upon the elegant curved bridge that led to the palace. They began to reach for their swords as we approached, and then saw me, then the princess, and they didn't know whether to bow or stare. They settled for looking down while casting quick sidelong glances as we walked past. Nowhere did I see Morden, but I very much suspected that he was following somewhere. I could have strangled the little bastard. Here I had made the observation that Mitsu had the attitude of a princess, and then I'd asked if Mitsu, whom I naturally assumed to be a male, was a prince. Morden could have bloody well told me at that point, but no, he had to play his little game. Granted, his well-timed shout-out had resulted in my winding up very much not dead, but even so, I reserved the right to be exceedingly annoyed with him. Once we got over the bridge, the first thing we were confronted with was stairs. I wasn't ecstatic about that. Stairs were and are a problem for me, and there wasn't anything else for it, really. Once we passed through the main gate, we walked upon dragons etched in bold relief in pavement blocks of carved marble. The palace was not simply a single building, but rather a series of buildings of varying sizes, contained within a walled-in area. The interior of the palace, the main hall, was breathtaking and as different from Runcible's castle as the sun from the moon. In addition to the marbled floors, the ceilings were deeply paneled and there were vast, elaborate carvings on everything. There were incense urns and figures of bronze, gorgeous tapestries, statues of great warriors from throughout the history of Chimpan. And there were courtiers beginning to emerge, bowing and scraping to the princess, and obviously being bewildered over my presence. I wasn't sure what the hell I was doing there either. Several of the courtiers came forward and extended their hands for my horse's reins.
Don't worry. Your animal will be well groomed and attended to.
Reluctantly, because I didn't want to deprive myself of the option of a fast getaway, I handed the reins over to the closest courtier, and they led the horse away. Ahead of us was a vast archway, and Mitsu glanced at me in a manner that could almost be described as impish.
Are you ready?
I somehow doubt it. What am I doing here, Mitsu?
Not a divinity, not princess.
Titles mean very little to me. I tend to judge the person by his or her qualities as an individual rather than the pretentiousness of a designation.
And who are you to judge?
No one and nothing, which makes me the ideal judge.
She had a nice laugh, at which point I nearly pulled out my sword and ran myself through with it. The absolute last thing I needed to do was become enamored with another princess.
Come then.
We walked in through the archway. The room we entered was as ornate as any of the others we'd been through, and there was a large throne positioned at the far end of it. The armrests of the throne were dragons carved from what appeared to be gold and silver intertwined. It was accessed by 3 small steps that led up to it, and seated upon the throne was an old man with a long, wispy white beard. Slowly, the man, whom I took to be the fabled Imperia, rose from his dragon throne. He was clothed in elaborate robes of red and purple, which seemed to envelop and even dwarf his body. He did not have enough hair on his head for a standard topknot, but instead his silvery hair hung short at the sides.
Down, now!
I realized that proper respect was going to have to be shown, presuming I wanted to continue breathing. I noticed interwoven mats upon the floor directly in front of the throne and immediately knelt on the closest one. The Imperia stood at the top of the stairs for what seemed an eternity.
So,
you have returned. You departed the Forbidden City without my permission. Against my wishes, in fact.
Yes.
If they are my wishes, they are the wishes of the gods. Do you defy the gods?
It was not my desire to defy anyone, but simply to live my life. The life you would deny me.
The life it is my right to deny you. Do you deny that?
Mitsu looked at me as if she was about to say something far more defiant, but then changed her mind. Instead, she simply stared resolutely ahead.
You have acted in a manner that is disgraceful, that brings dishonor to your name and to the dragon throne. Honor must be restored.
I felt a chill gripping my spine. I didn't know where this was going, but I couldn't say I liked the drift of it. In a moment, three young women dressed in silk kimonos ran in quickly. They moved lightly, almost as if they were dancing upon their toes. With their hair done up identically and the same sort of makeup, they were almost impossible to distinguish one from the other.
Your handmaids, they have missed you. Choose one.
Choose?
One. To die in your stead and so preserve your honor.
I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was madness. Madness. Certainly she would say something to intercede, come up with some way to save the life of an innocent young woman who had done nothing to deserve...
That one.
But surely the handmaiden would protest, cry, plead for her life, put forward her sense of betrayal or... The handmaiden promptly dropped to her knees.
It is an honor.
She fell forward so softly I never even heard her hit the floor. At which point I knew I was definitely in an asylum that had been taken over by madmen. I had gone through my life encountering people who had no sense of honor, or else possessed honor in a way that was personally convenient. Here in Chimpan, honor had been taken to the opposite degree. It had been elevated to a point where it superseded compassion or wisdom or even basic humanity. Life itself had no meaning other than to lay it down at the most capricious of whims. The Imperia didn't even glance at the handmaiden who had taken her own life on behalf of his daughter. Instead, to my gnawing horror, he turned his attention to me.
And this?
I waited for her to provide an explanation for me, to come up with some way of finessing a way around the obvious fact that I was like nothing her father had ever seen, which would inherently be fatal.
Well?
More silence. I risked a glance in Mitsu's direction, surreptitiously under one of my arms. Her lips were thinned, her face impassive. She wasn't going to say a damned thing. My mouth was suddenly very dry as I realized I was about a sentence or two away from death. Fortunately enough, it was when I was at my most desperate that I was usually at my best.
She does not answer, O Divine One, because she is aware that you already know the answer.
There was a pause, during which, for not the first time, my life flashed before my eyes. I couldn't say I was any prouder of it this go-around than before.
Indeed?
Well, of course. How could you not? After all, you are the...
Blood from the fallen handmaiden was trickling toward me. I moved my feet carefully, trying not to be ill.
You are the chosen of the gods. Naturally, it would be unthinkable that you would not know who I am and from where I hail.
Yes, it would be unthinkable. So, tell me, what do you think I know?
I think you know that my name is Poe, that I am an ambassador from the state of Asteria, from the ruler known as Runcible.
And you have, of course, brought me an offering from your king.
I froze for a moment and then reached into the hidden compartment of my staff and extracted several Asterian coins.
These are exceptionally valuable, very limited in number. He wanted you to have them.
It was just a couple of sols, nothing special. But they had the king's features imprinted upon them. The Imperia took them and studied them thoughtfully.
Very generous. And of course, you are able to guess how your king knew of our land.
My brain froze. I cursed myself for a fool. That simple notion had not occurred to me. I didn't have the slightest inkling how King Runcible, or in point of fact any monarch I might have served back in my homeland, could possibly have come to have knowledge of the land of Chimpan. But then I calmed as I realized I didn't have to know. The whole point of this wasn't to cover my knowledge, it was to cover the Imperia's lack of same.